paid off its $465 million loan from the government early and with interest. Tesla suddenly appeared to have vast cash reserves at its disposal, and the short sellers were forced to take massive losses. The solid performance of the stock increased consumers' confidence, creating a virtuous circle for Tesla. With cars selling and Tesla's value rising, the deal with Google was no longer necessary, and Tesla had become too expensive to buy. The talks with Google ended. Google's attorneys had asked to make a presentation to Tesla's board. Before he would permit this, Musk asked for the right to call on Google for a loan in case Tesla encountered cash flow issues after acquisition talks became public, as there would otherwise be no way for Tesla to raise money. Google hesitated on this for a few weeks, by which time Tesla ended up in the clear. What transpired next was the summer of Musk. Musk put his public relations staff on high alert, telling them that he wanted to try to have one Tesla announcement per week. The company never quite lived up to that pace, but it did issue statement after statement. Musk held a series of press conferences that addressed financing for the Model S, the construction of more charging stations, and the opening of more retail stores. During one announcement, Musk noted that Tesla's charging stations were solar-powered and had batteries on-site to store extra juice. "I was joking that even if there's some zombie apocalypse, you'll still be able to travel throughout the country using the Tesla supercharger system," Musk said, setting the bar very high for CEOs at other automakers. But the biggest event by far was held in Los Angeles, where Tesla unveiled another secret feature of the Model S. In June 2013, Tesla cleared the prototype vehicles out of its Los Angeles design studio and invited Tesla owners and the media for a flashy evening soiree. Hundreds of people showed up, driving their pricey Model S sedans through the grungy streets of Hawthorne and parking in between the design studio and the SpaceX factory. The studio had been converted into a lounge. The lighting was dim, and the floor had been covered in AstroTurf and tiered to make plateaus where people could mingle or plop down on couches. Women in tight black dresses cruised through the crowd, serving drinks. Daft Punk's Get Lucky played on the sound system. A stage had been built at the front of the room, but before Musk ascended it, he mingled with the masses. It was clear that he had become a rock star for Tesla owners, every bit the equivalent of Steve Jobs for the Apple faithful. People surrounded him and asked to take pictures. Meanwhile, Straubel stood off to the side, often totally alone. After people had a couple of drinks, Musk fought through the crowd to the front of the room, where old TV commercials projected onto a screen above the stage showed families stopping by Esso and Chevron stations. The kids were so happy to see the Esso tiger mascot. "Gas is a weird thing to love," Musk said. "Honestly." That's when he brought a Model S up on stage. A hole opened up in the floor beneath the car. "It had been possible all along," Musk said, "to replace the battery pack underneath the Model S in a matter of seconds. The company just hadn't told anyone about this." Tesla would now start adding battery swapping at its charging stations as a quicker option to recharging. Someone could drive right over a pit where a robot would take off the car's battery pack and install a new one in 90 seconds, at cost equivalent to filling up with a tank of gas. "The only decision that you have to make when you come to one of our Tesla stations is, do you prefer faster or free?" Musk said. Following the demonstration, Tesla struggled to deliver on the battery swap technology. Musk had promised that the first few stations would arrive in late 2013. A year after the event, though, Tesla had yet to open a single station. According to Musk, the company ended up needing to deal with more pressing issues. "We're going to do it because we said we'd do it," Musk said. "It may not be on the schedule that we'd like, but we always come through in the end." In the months that followed, A couple of events threatened to derail the summer of Musk. The New York Times penned a withering review of the car and its charging stations, and a couple of the Model S sedans caught fire after being involved in collisions. Disobeying conventional public relations wisdom, Musk went after the reporter, using data pulled from the car to undermine the reviewer's claims. Musk penned the feisty rebuttal himself, while on vacation in Aspen with Kimball and friend and Tesla board member Antonio Gracias. At some other company, it would be a public relations group putting something like this together, Gracias said. Elon felt like it was the most important problem facing Tesla at the time, and that's always what he deals with and how he prioritizes. It could kill the car and represented an existential threat against the business. Have there been moments where his unconventional style in these types of situations has made me cringe? Yes. But I trust that it will work out in the end. Musk applied a similar approach to dealing with the fires by declaring the Model S the safest car in America in a press release and adding a titanium underbody shield and aluminum plates to the vehicle to deflect and destroy debris and keep the battery pack safe. The fires, the occasional bad review, none of this had any effect on Tesla's sales or share price. Musk's star shone brighter and brighter as Tesla's market value ballooned to about half that of GM and Ford. Tesla held another press event in October 2014 that cemented Musk's place as the new titan of the auto industry. Musk unveiled a supercharged version of the Model S with two motors, one in the front and one in the back. It could go 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds. The company had turned a sedan into a supercar. "It's like taking off from a carrier deck," Musk said. "It's just bananas." Musk also unveiled a new suite of software for the Model S that gave it autopilot functions. The car had radar to detect objects and warn of possible collisions and could guide itself via GPS. "Later you will be able to summon the car," Musk said. "It will come to wherever you are. There's also something else I would like to do. Many of our engineers will be hearing this in real time. I would like the charge connector to plug itself into the car, sort of like an articulating snake. I think we will probably do something like that." Thousands of people waited in line for hours to see Musk demonstrate this technology. Musk cracked jokes during the presentation and played off the crowd's enthusiasm. The man who had been awkward in front of media during the PayPal years had developed a unique, slick stagecraft. A woman standing next to me in the crowd went weak in the knees when Musk first took the stage. A man to my other side said he wanted a Model X and had just offered $15,000 to a friend to move up on the reservation list so that he could end up with model number 700. The enthusiasm, coupled with Musk's ability to generate attention, was emblematic of just how far the little automaker and its eccentric CEO had come. Rival car companies would kill to receive such interest and had basically been left dumbfounded as Tesla snuck up on them and delivered more than they had ever imagined possible. As the Model S fever gripped Silicon Valley, I visited Ford's small research and development lab in Palo Alto. The head of the lab at the time was a ponytailed, sandal-wearing engineer named T.J. Julie, who felt very jealous of Tesla. Inside of every Ford were dozens of computing systems made by different companies that all had to speak to each other and work as one. It was a mess of complexity that had evolved over time, and simplifying the situation would prove near impossible at this point, especially for a company like Ford, which needed to pump out hundreds of thousands of cars per year and could not afford to stop and reboot. Tesla, by contrast, got to start from scratch and make its own software the focus of the Model S. Julie would have loved the same opportunity. "Software is in many ways the heart of the new vehicle experience," he said. "From the powertrain to the warning chimes in the car, you're using software to create an expressive and pleasing environment. The level of integration that the software has into the rest of the Model S is really impressive. Tesla is a benchmark for what we do here. Not long after this chat, Julie left Ford to become an engineer at a stealth startup. There was little the mainstream auto industry could do to slow Tesla down, but that didn't stop executives from trying to be difficult whenever possible. Tesla, for example, wanted to call its third-generation car the Model E, so that its lineup of vehicles would be the Model S, E, and X, another playful Musk gag. But Ford's then-CEO, Alan Mulally, blocked Tesla from using Model E with the threat of a lawsuit. So I call up Mulally, and I was like, "Alan, are you just fucking with us, or are you really going to do a Model E?" Musk said. "And I'm not sure which is worse, you know? Like, it would actually make more sense if they're just fucking with us, because if they actually come out with a Model E at this point, and we've got the Model S and the X, and Ford comes out with the Model E, it's going to look ridiculous. So even though Ford did the Model T 100 years ago, nobody thinks of Model as being a Ford thing anymore. So we just feel like they stole it. So why did they go steal Tesla's E? Like you're some sort of fascist army marching across the alphabet, some sort of Sesame Street robber." And he was like, no, we're definitely going to use it." And I was like, "Oh, I don't think that's such a good idea, because people are going to be confused, because it's not going to make sense. People aren't used to Ford having Model something these days. It's usually called, like, the Ford Fusion." And he was like, "No, his guys really want to use that. That's terrible." After that, Tesla registered the trademark for Model Y as another joke. In fact, Ford called us up deadpan and said, "We see you've registered Model Y. Is that what you're going to use instead of the Model E?" Musk said. I'm like, "No, it's a joke. S-E-X-Y. What does that spell?" But trademark law is a dry profession, it turns out. As for the origins of the Model S name, Musk said, "Well, I like calling things what they are. We had the Roadster, but there was no good word for a sedan. You can't call it the Tesla sedan. That's boring as hell. In the UK, they say saloon, but then it's sort of like, what are you, a cowboy or something? We went through a bunch of iterations, and the Model S sounded the best. And it was like a vague nod to Ford being the Model T, in that electric cars preceded the Model T, and in a way were coming full circle. And the thing that preceded the Model T is now going into production in the 21st century, hence the Model S. But that's sort of more like reversing the logic. What Musk had done that the rival automakers missed or didn't have the means to combat was turn Tesla into a lifestyle. It did not just sell someone a car. It sold them an image, a feeling they were tapping into the future, a relationship. Apple did the same thing decades ago with the Mac, and then again with the iPod and iPhone. Even those who were not religious about their affiliation to Apple were sucked into its universe once they bought the hardware and downloaded software like iTunes. This sort of relationship is hard to pull off if you don't control as much of the lifestyle as possible. PC makers that farmed their software out to Microsoft, their chips to Intel, and their design to Asia could never make machines as beautiful and as complete as Apple's. They also could not respond in time, as Apple took this expertise to new areas and hooked people on its applications. You can see Musk's embrace of the car as lifestyle in Tesla's abandonment of model years. Tesla does not designate cars as being 2014s or 2015s, and it also doesn't have "all the 2014s in stock must go, go, go and make room for the new cars" sales. It produces the best Model S it can at the time, and that's what the customer receives. This means that Tesla does not develop and hold on to a bunch of new features over the course of the year and then unleash them in a new model all at once. It adds features one by one to the manufacturing line when they're ready. Some customers may be frustrated to miss out on a feature here and there, Tesla, however, manages to deliver most of the upgrades as software updates that everyone gets, providing current Model S owners with pleasant surprises. For the Model S owner, the all-electric lifestyle translates into a less hassled existence. Instead of going to the gas station, you just plug the car in at night, a rhythm familiar to anyone with a smartphone. The car will start charging right away, or the owner can tap into the Model S's software and schedule charging to take place late at night, when the cheapest electricity rates are available. Tesla owners not only dodge gas stations, they mostly get to skip out on visits to mechanics. A traditional vehicle needs oil and transmission fluid changes to deal with all the friction and wear and tear produced by its thousands of moving parts. The simpler electric car design eliminates this type of maintenance. Both the Roadster and the Model S also take advantage of what's known as regenerative braking, which extends the life of the brakes. During stop-and-go situations, the Tesla will brake by kicking the motor into reverse via software and slowing down the wheels instead of using brake pads and friction to clamp them down. The Tesla motor generates electricity during this process and funnels it back to the batteries, which is why electric cars get better mileage in city traffic. Tesla still recommends that owners bring in the Model S once a year for a checkup, but that's mostly to give the vehicle a once-over and make sure that none of the components seems to be wearing down prematurely. Even Tesla's approach to maintenance is philosophically different from that of the traditional automotive industry. Most car dealers make the majority of their profits from servicing cars. They treat vehicles like a subscription service, expecting people to visit their service centers multiple times a year for many years. This is the main reason dealerships have fought to block Tesla from selling its cars directly to consumers. A handful of lawsuits have been filed against Tesla, with auto dealers arguing that the company should not be able to sell its cars directly. But even in those states that have banned Tesla's stores, prospective customers can usually request a test drive, and someone from Tesla will show up with a vehicle. Sometimes you have to put something out there for people to attack, Musk said. In the long run, the stores won't be important. The way things will really grow is by word of mouth. The stores are like a viral seed to get things going. The ultimate goal is to never have to bring your car back in after you buy it, said Javidan. The dealers charge more than independent mechanics, but give people the peace of mind that their car is being worked on by a specialist for a particular make of vehicle. Tesla makes its profits off the initial sale of the car, and then from some optional software services. I got the number 10 Model S, said Konstantin Othmer, the Silicon Valley software whiz and entrepreneur. It was an awesome car, but it had just about every issue you might have read about in the forums. They would fix all these things and decided to trailer the car back to the shop so they didn't add any miles to it. Then I went in for a one-year service, and they spruced up everything so that the car was better than new. It was surrounded by velvet ropes in the service center. It was just beautiful. Tesla's model isn't just about being an affront to the way carmakers and dealers do business. It's a more subtle play on how electric cars represent a new way to think of automobiles. All car companies will soon follow Tesla's lead and offer some form of over-the-air updates to their vehicles. The practicality and scope of their updates will be limited, however. You just can't do an over-the-air spark plug change or replacement of the timing belt, said Javidan. With a gas car, you have to get under the hood at some point, and that forces you back to the dealership anyway. There's no real incentive for Mercedes to say, you don't need to bring the car in, because it's not true. Tesla also has the edge of having designed so many of the key components for its cars in-house, including the software running throughout the vehicle. If Daimler wants to change the way a gauge looks, it has to contact a supplier half a world away and then wait for a series of approvals, Javidan said. It would take them a year to change the way the P on the instrument panel looks. At Tesla, if Elon decides he wants a picture of a bunny rabbit on every gauge for Easter, he can have that done in a couple of hours. Or as Straubel put it, watching people drive the Model S across the country is phenomenal. There is no way you can do that in anything else. It's not about putting a charging station in the desert as a stunt. It's about realizing where this is going to go. We will end up launching the third generation car into a world where this charging network is free and ubiquitous. It bugs me when people compare us to a car company. The cars are absolutely our main product, but we are also an energy company and a technology company. We are going down to the dirt and having discussions with mining companies about the materials for our batteries and going up to commercialize all the pieces that make up an electronic vehicle and all the pieces that make an awesome product. As Tesla turned into a star of modern American industry, its closest rivals were obliterated. Fisker Automotive filed for bankruptcy and was bought by a Chinese auto parts company in 2014. One of its main investors was Ray Lane, a venture capitalist at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. Lane had cost Kleiner Perkins a chance to invest in Tesla and then backed Fisker, a disastrous move that tarnished the firm's brand and Lane's reputation. Better Place was another startup that enjoyed more hype than Fisker and Tesla put together and raised close to $1 billion to build electric cars and battery swapping stations. The company never produced much of anything and declared bankruptcy in 2013. The guys like Strobel, who had been at Tesla since the beginning, are quick to remind people that the chance to build an awesome electric car had been there all along. "It's not really like there was a rush to this idea and we got there first," Strobel said. It is frequently forgotten in hindsight that people thought this was the shittiest business opportunity on the planet. The venture capitalists were all running for the hills. What separated Tesla from the competition was the willingness to charge after its vision without compromise, a complete commitment to execute to Musk's standards. Chapter 11. The Unified Field Theory of Elon Musk. The Rive brothers used to be like a technology gang. In the late 1990s, they would jump on skateboards and zip around the streets of Santa Cruz, knocking on the doors of businesses and asking if they needed any help managing their computing systems. The young men, who had all grown up in South Africa with their cousin Elon Musk, soon decided there must be an easier way to hawk their technology smarts than going door to door. They wrote some software that allowed them to take control of their client systems from afar and to automate many of the standard tasks that companies required, such as installing updates for applications. The software became the basis of a new company called Everdream, and the brothers promoted their technology in some compelling ways. Billboards went up around Silicon Valley in which Lyndon Rive, a buff underwater hockey player — no, really, both Lyndon and his wife play underwater hockey and use these skills to secure green cards, meeting the criteria for the exceptional abilities the United States desires. They ultimately played for the U.S. national teams. Stood naked with his pants around his ankles while holding a computer in front of his crotch. Up above his photo, the tagline for the ad read, "Don't get caught with your systems down." By 2004, Lyndon and his brothers Peter and Russ wanted a new challenge, something that not only made them money, but as Lyndon put it, "something that made us feel good every single day." Near the end of the summer that year, Lyndon rented an RV and set out with Musk for the Black Rock Desert and the madness of Burning Man. The men used to go on adventures all the time when they were kids and looked forward to the long drive as a way to catch up and brainstorm about their businesses. Musk knew that Lyndon and his brothers were angling for something big. While driving, Musk turned to Lyndon and suggested that he look into the solar energy market. Musk had studied it a bit and thought there were some opportunities that others had missed. "He said it was a good place to get into," Lyndon recalled. After arriving at Burning Man, Musk, a regular at the event, and his family went through their standard routines. They set up camp and prepped their art car for a drive. This year they had cut the roof off a small car, elevated the steering wheel, shifted it to the right so that it was placed near the middle of the vehicle, and replaced the seats with a couch. Musk took a lot of pleasure in driving the funky creation. "Elon likes to see the rawness of people there," said Bill Lee, his longtime friend. "It's his version of camping. He wants to go and drive the art cars and see installations and the great light shows. He dances a lot. Musk put on a display of strength and determination at the event as well. There was a wooden pole perhaps 30 feet high with a dancing platform at the top. Dozens of people tried and failed to climb it, and then Musk gave it a go. His technique was very awkward, and he should not have succeeded, said Lyndon. But he hugged it and just inched up and inched up until he reached the top. Musk and the Rives left Burning Man enthused. The Rives decided to become experts on the solar industry and find the opportunity in the market. They spent 2 years studying solar technology and the dynamics of the business, reading research reports, interviewing people, and attending conferences along the way. It was during the Solar Power International Conference that the Rive brothers really hit on what their business model might be. Only about 2,000 people showed up for the event. 13,000 people showed up in 2013. And they all fit into a couple of hotel conference rooms for presentations and panels. During one open discussion session, representatives from a handful of the world's largest solar installers were sitting on stage, and the moderator asked what they were doing to make solar panels more affordable for consumers. They all gave the same answer, Lyndon said. They said, "We're waiting for the cost of the panels to drop." None of them were taking ownership of the problem. At the time, it was not easy for consumers to get solar panels on their houses. You had to be very proactive, acquiring the panels and finding someone else to install them. The consumer paid up front and had to make an educated guess as to whether or not his or her house even got enough sunshine to make the ordeal worthwhile. On top of all this, people were reluctant to buy panels, knowing that the next year's models would be more efficient. The Rives decided to make buying into the solar proposition much simpler and formed a company called Solar City in 2006. Unlike other companies, they would not manufacture their own solar panels. Instead, they would buy them and then do just about everything else in-house. They built software for analyzing a customer's current energy bill and the position of their house and the amount of sunlight it typically received to determine if solar made sense for the property. They built up their own teams to install the solar panels, and they created a financing system in which the customer did not need to pay anything up front for the panels. The consumer leased the panels over a number of years at a fixed monthly rate. Consumers got a lower bill overall, they were no longer subject to the constantly rising rates of typical utilities, and if they sold their house, they could pass the contract to the new owner. At the end of the lease, the homeowner could also upgrade to new, more efficient panels. Musk had helped his cousins come up with this structure and become the company's chairman and its largest shareholder, owning about a third of Solar City. 6 years later, Solar City had become the largest installer of solar panels in the country. The company had lived up to its initial goals and made installing the panels painless. Rivals were rushing to mimic its business model. Solar City had benefited along the way from a collapse in the price of solar panels, which occurred after Chinese panel manufacturers flooded the market with product. It had also expanded its business from consumers to businesses, with companies like Intel, Walgreens, and Walmart signing up for large installations. In 2012, Solar City went public, and its shares soared higher in the months that followed. By 2014, Solar City was valued at close to $7 billion. During the entire period of Solar City's growth, Silicon Valley had dumped huge amounts of money into green technology companies with mostly disastrous results. There were the automotive flubs like Fisker and Better Place, and Solyndra, the solar cell maker that conservatives love to hold up as a cautionary tale of government spending and cronyism run amok. Some of the most famous venture capitalists in history, like John Doerr and Vinod Khosla, were ripped apart by the local and national press for their failed green investments. The story was almost always the same. People had thrown money at green technology because it seemed like the right thing to do, not because it made business sense. From new kinds of energy storage systems to electric cars and solar panels, the technology never quite lived up to its billing and required too much government funding and too many incentives to create a viable market. Much of this criticism was fair. It's just that there was this Elon Musk guy hanging around who seemed to have figured something out that everyone else had missed. "We had a blanket rule against investing in clean tech companies for about a decade," said Peter Thiel, the PayPal co-founder and venture capitalist at Founders Fund. "On the macro level, we were right, because clean tech as a sector was quite bad. But on the micro level, it looks like Elon has the two most successful clean tech companies in the U.S. We would rather explain his success as being a fluke. There's the whole Iron Man thing, in which he's presented as a cartoonish businessman, the very unusual animal at the zoo. But there is now a degree to which you have to ask whether his success is an indictment on the rest of us, who have been working on much more incremental things. To the extent that the world still doubts Elon, I think it's a reflection on the insanity of the world and not on the supposed insanity of Elon." SolarCity, like the rest of Musk's ventures, did not represent a business opportunity so much as it represented a worldview. Musk had decided long ago, in his very rational manner, that solar made sense. Enough solar energy hits the Earth's surface in about an hour to equal a year's worth of worldwide energy consumption from all sources put together. Improvements in the efficiency of solar panels had been happening at a steady clip. If solar is destined to be mankind's preferred energy source in the future, then this future ought to be brought about as quickly as possible. Starting in 2014, SolarCity began to make the full extent of its ambitions more obvious. First, the company began selling energy storage systems. These units were built through a partnership with Tesla Motors. Battery packs were manufactured at the Tesla factory and stacked inside refrigerator-sized metal cases. Businesses and consumers could purchase these storage systems to augment their solar panel arrays. Once they were charged up, the battery units could be used to help large customers get through the night or during unexpected outages. Customers could also pull from the batteries instead of the grid during peak energy use periods, when utilities tend to tack on extra charges. While SolarCity rolled the storage units out in a modest experimental fashion, the company expects most of its customers to buy the systems in the years ahead to smooth out the solar experience and help people and businesses leave the electrical grid altogether. Then, in June 2014, SolarCity acquired a solar cell maker called Silevo for $200 million. This deal marked a huge shift in strategy. SolarCity would no longer buy its solar panels. It would make them at a factory in New York State. Silevo's cells were said to be 18.5% efficient at turning light into energy, compared to 14.5% for most cells, and the expectations were that the company could reach 24% efficiency with the right manufacturing techniques. Buying, rather than manufacturing, solar panels had been one of SolarCity's great advantages. It could capitalize on the glut in the solar cell market and avoid the large capital expenditures tied to building and running factories. With 110,000 customers, however, SolarCity had started to consume so many solar panels that it needed to ensure a consistent supply and price. "We are currently installing more solar than most of the companies are manufacturing," said Peter Rive, the co-founder and chief technology officer at SolarCity. "If we do the manufacturing ourselves and take advantage of some different technology, our costs will be lower. And this business has always been about lowering the costs." After adding the leases, the storage units, and the solar cell manufacturing together, it became clear to close observers of SolarCity that the company had morphed into something resembling a utility. It had built out a network of solar systems all under its control and managed by the company's software. By the end of 2015, SolarCity expects to have installed 2 gigawatts worth of solar panels, producing 2.8 terawatt hours of electricity per year. "This would put us on a path to fulfill our goal to become one of the largest suppliers of electricity in the United States," the company said, after announcing these figures in a quarterly earnings statement. The reality is that SolarCity accounts for a tiny fraction of the United States' annual energy consumption, and has a long way to go to become a major supplier of electricity in the country. There can, however, be little doubt that Musk intends for the company to be a dominant force in the solar industry and in the energy industry overall. What's more, SolarCity is a key part of what can be thought of as the unified field theory of Musk. Each one of his businesses is interconnected in the short term and the long term. Tesla makes battery packs that SolarCity can then sell to end customers. SolarCity supplies Tesla's charging stations with solar panels, helping Tesla to provide free recharging to its drivers. Newly minted Model S owners regularly opt to begin living the Musk lifestyle and outfit their homes with solar panels. Tesla and SpaceX help each other as well. They exchange knowledge around materials, manufacturing techniques, and the intricacies of operating factories that build so much stuff from the ground up. For most of their histories, SolarCity, Tesla, and SpaceX have been the clear underdogs in their respective markets and gone to war against deep-pocketed, entrenched competitors. The solar, automotive, and aerospace industries remain larded down by regulation and bureaucracy, which favors incumbents. To people in these industries, Musk came off as a wide-eyed technologist who could be easily dismissed and ridiculed, and who, as a competitor, fell somewhere on the spectrum between annoying and full of shit. The incumbents did their usual thing, using their connections in Washington to make life as miserable as possible on all three of Musk's companies, and they were pretty good at it. As of 2012, Musk Company turned into a real threat, and it became harder to go at SolarCity, Tesla, or SpaceX as individual companies. Musk's star power had surged and washed over all three ventures at the same time. When Tesla's shares jumped, quite often SolarCity's did too. Similar optimistic feelings accompanied successful SpaceX launches. They proved Musk knew how to accomplish the most difficult of things, and investors seemed to buy in more to the risks Musk took with his other enterprises. The executives and lobbyists of aerospace, energy, and automotive companies were suddenly going up against a rising star of big business, an industrialist celebrity. Some of Musk's opponents started to fear being on the wrong side of history, or at least the wrong side of his glow. Others began playing really dirty. Musk has spent years buttering up the Democrats. He's visited the White House several times and has the ear of President Obama. Musk, however, is not a blind loyalist. He first and foremost backs the beliefs behind Musk Company, and then uses any pragmatic means at his disposal to advance his cause. Musk plays the part of the ruthless industrialist with a fierce capitalist streak better than most Republicans, and has the credentials to back it up and earn support. The politicians in states like Alabama, looking to protect some factory jobs for Lockheed, or in New Jersey, trying to help out the automobile dealership lobby, now have to contend with a guy who has an employment and manufacturing empire spread across the entire United States. As of this writing, SpaceX had a factory in Los Angeles, a rocket test facility in Central Texas, and had just started construction on a spaceport in South Texas. SpaceX does a lot of business at existing launch sites in California and Florida as well. Tesla had its car factory in Silicon Valley, the design center in Los Angeles, and had started construction on a battery factory in Nevada. Politicians from Nevada, Texas, California, New Mexico, and Arizona threw themselves at Musk over the battery factory, with Nevada ultimately winning the business by offering Tesla $1.4 billion in incentives. This event confirmed not only Musk's soaring celebrity, but also his unmatched ability to raise funds. SolarCity has created thousands of white and blue-collar clean tech jobs, and it will create manufacturing jobs at the solar panel factory that's being built in Buffalo, New York. Altogether, Musk Company employed about 15,000 people at the end of 2014. Far from stopping there, the plan for Musk Company calls for tens of thousands of more jobs to be created on the back of ever more ambitious products. Tesla's primary focus throughout 2015 will be bringing the Model X to market. Musk expects the SUV to sell at least as well as the Model S, and wants Tesla's factories to be capable of making 100,000 cars per year by the end of 2015 to keep up with demand for both vehicles. The major downside accompanying the Model X is its price. The SUV will start at the same lofty prices as the Model S, which limits the potential customer base. The hope, though, is that the Model X turns into the luxury vehicle of choice for families and solidifies the Tesla brand's connection with women. Musk has pledged that the supercharger network, service centers, and the battery swap stations will be built out even more in 2015 to greet the arrival of the new vehicle. Beyond the Model X, Tesla has started work on the second version of the Roadster, talked about making a truck, and, in all seriousness, has begun modeling a type of submarine car that could transition from road to water. Musk paid $1 million for the Lotus Esprit that Roger Moore drove underwater in The Spy Who Loved Me, and wants to prove that such a vehicle can be done. "Maybe we'll make two or three, but it wouldn't be more than that," Musk told the Independent newspaper. "I think the market for submarine cars is quite small." At the opposite end of the sales spectrum, or so Musk hopes, will be Tesla's third-generation car, or the Model 3. Due out in 2017, this four-door car would come in around $35,000 and be the real measure of Tesla's impact on the world. The company hopes to sell hundreds of thousands of the Model 3 and make electric cars truly mainstream. For comparison, BMW sells about 300,000 Minis and 500,000 of its BMW 3 Series vehicles per year. Tesla would look to match those figures. "I think Tesla is going to make a lot of cars," Musk said. "If we continue on the current growth rate, I think Tesla will be one of the most valuable companies in the world." Tesla already consumes a huge portion of the world's lithium-ion battery supply and will need far more batteries to produce the Model 3. This is why, in 2014, Musk announced plans to build what he dubbed the Gigafactory, or the world's largest lithium-ion manufacturing facility. Each Gigafactory will employ about 6,500 people and help Tesla meet a variety of goals. It should first allow Tesla to keep up with the battery demand created by its cars and the storage units sold by SolarCity. Tesla also expects to be able to lower the costs of its batteries while improving their energy density. It will build the Gigafactory in conjunction with longtime battery partner Panasonic, but it will be Tesla that is running the factory and fine-tuning its operations. According to Straubel, the battery packs coming out of the Gigafactory should be dramatically cheaper and better than the ones built today, allowing Tesla not only to hit the $35,000 price target for the Model 3, but also to pave the way for electric vehicles with 500-plus miles of range. If Tesla actually can deliver an affordable car with 500 miles of range, it will have built what many people in the auto industry insisted for years was impossible. To do that, while also constructing a worldwide network of free charging stations, revamping the way cars are sold, and revolutionizing automotive technology, would be an exceptional feat in the history of capitalism. In early 2014, Tesla raised $2 billion by selling bonds. Tesla's ability to raise money from eager investors was a newfound luxury. Tesla had bordered on bankruptcy for much of its existence and been one major technical gaffe from obsolescence at all times. The money, coupled with Tesla's still rising share price and strong sales, has put the company in a position to open lots of new stores and service centers while advancing its manufacturing capabilities. "We don't necessarily need all of the money for the Gigafactory right now, but I decided to raise it in advance because you never know when there will be some bloody meltdown," Musk said. "There could be external factors, or there could be some unexpected recall, and then suddenly we need to raise money on top of dealing with that. I feel a bit like my grandmother. She lived through the Great Depression and some real hard times. Once you've been through that, it stays with you for a long time. I'm not sure it ever leaves, really. So I do feel joy now, but there's still that nagging feeling that it might all go away. Even later in life, when my grandmother knew there was really no possibility of her going hungry, She always had this thing about food. With Tesla, I decided to raise a huge amount of money just in case something terrible happens. Musk felt optimistic enough about Tesla's future to talk to me about some of his more whimsical plans. He hopes to redesign the Tesla headquarters in Palo Alto, a change employees would welcome. The building, with its tiny 1980s-era lobby and a kitchen that can barely handle a few people making cereal at the same time, has none of the perks of a typical Silicon Valley darling. "I think our Tesla headquarters looks like crap," Musk said. "We're going to spruce things up, not to sort of the Google level. You have to be like making money hand over fist in order to be able to spend money the way that Google does. But we're going to make our headquarters much nicer and put in a restaurant." Naturally, Musk had ideas for some mechanical enhancements as well. "Everybody around here has slides in their lobbies," he said. "I'm actually wondering about putting in a roller coaster, like a functional roller coaster, at the factory in Fremont. You'd get in, and it would take you around factory, but also up and down. Who else has a roller coaster? I'm thinking about doing that with SpaceX, too. That one might be even bigger, since SpaceX has like 10 buildings now. It would probably be really expensive, but I like the idea of it." What's fascinating is that Musk remains willing to lose it all. He doesn't want to build just one gigafactory, but several. And he needs these facilities to be built quickly and flawlessly, so that they're cranking out massive quantities of batteries right as the Model 3 arrives. If need be, Musk will build a second gigafactory to compete with the Nevada site and place his own employees in competition with each other in a race to make the batteries first. "We're not really trying to sort of yank anyone's chain here," Musk said. "It's just like this thing needs to be completed on time. If we suddenly find that we're leveling the ground and laying the foundation and we're on a bloody Indian burial ground, then fuck. We can't say, 'Oh shit, let's go back to the other place that we were thinking about and get a 6-month reset.' 6 months for this factory is a huge deal. Do the basic math, and it's more than $1 billion a month in lost revenue, assuming we use it to capacity. If you assume an average selling price of $40,000 per car for 300,000 cars sold in a year, that's $12 billion in annual revenue, or $1 billion per month. From a different standpoint, if we spend all the money to prepare the car factory in Fremont to triple the volume from 150,000 per year to 450,000 or 500,000 cars and hire and train all the people, and we're just sitting there waiting for the factory to come online, we'd be burning money like it was going out of fashion. I think that could kill the company. A 6-month offset would be like Gallipoli. You have to make sure you charge right after the bombardment. Don't fucking sit around for 2 hours so that the Turks can go back in the trenches. Timing is important. We have to do everything we can to minimize the timing risk. What Musk struggles to fathom is why other automakers with deeper pockets aren't making similar moves. At a minimum, Tesla seems to have influenced consumers and the auto industry enough for there to be an expected surge in demand for electric vehicles. "I think we have moved the needle for almost every car company," Musk said. "Just the 22,000 cars we sold in 2013 had a highly leveraged effect in pushing the industry towards sustainable technology. It's true that the supply for lithium-ion batteries is already constrained, and Tesla looks like the only company addressing the problem in a meaningful way." "The competitors are all sort of poo-pooing the Gigafactory," Musk said. "They think it's a stupid idea, that the battery supplier should just go build something like that. But I know all the suppliers, and I can tell you that they don't like the idea of spending several $1 billion on a battery factory. You've got a chicken-and-egg problem, where the car companies are not going to commit to a giant volume because they're not sure you can sell enough electric cars. So I know we can't get enough lithium-ion batteries unless we build this bloody factory, and I know no one else is building this thing." There's the potential that Tesla is setting itself up to capitalize on a situation like the one Apple found itself in when it first introduced the iPhone. Apple's rivals spent the initial year after the iPhone's release dismissing the product. Once it became clear Apple had a hit, the competitors had to catch up. Even with a device right in their hands, it took companies like HTC and Samsung years to produce anything comparable. Other once great companies like Nokia and BlackBerry didn't withstand the shock. If, and it's a big if, Tesla's Model 3 turned into a massive hit, the thing that everyone with enough money wanted because buying something else would just be paying for the past, then the rival automakers would be in a terrible bind. Most of the car companies dabbling in electric vehicles continue to buy bulky, off-the-shelf batteries rather than developing their own technology. No matter how much they wanted to respond to the Model 3, the automakers would need years to come up with a real challenger, and even then, they might not have a ready supply of batteries for their vehicles. "I think it's going to be a bit like that," Musk said. "When will the first non-Tesla gigafactory get built? Probably no sooner than 6 years from now. The big car companies are so derivative. They want to see it work somewhere else before they will approve the project and move forward. They're probably more like 7 years away, but I hope I'm wrong." Musk speaks about the cars, solar panels, and batteries with such passion that it's easy to forget they are more or less sideline projects. He believes in the technologies to the extent that he thinks they're the right things to pursue for the betterment of mankind. They've also brought him fame and fortune. Musk's ultimate goal, though, remains turning humans into an interplanetary species. This may sound silly to some, but there can be no doubt that this is Musk's raison d'être. Musk has decided that man's survival depends on setting up another colony on another planet, and that he should dedicate his life to making this happen. Musk is now quite rich on paper. He was worth about $10 billion at the time of this writing. When he started SpaceX more than a decade ago, however, he had far less capital at his disposal. He didn't have the fuck you money of a Jeff Bezos, who handed his space company Blue Origin a kingly pile of cash and asked it to make Bezos' dreams come true. If Musk wanted to get to Mars, he would have to earn it by building SpaceX into a real business. This all seems to have worked in Musk's favor. SpaceX has learned to make cheap and effective rockets and to push the limits of aerospace technology. In the near term, SpaceX will begin testing its ability to take people into space. It wants to perform a manned test flight by 2016, and to fly astronauts to the International Space Station for NASA the next year. The company will also likely make a major move into building and selling satellites, which would mark an expansion into one of the most lucrative parts of the aerospace business. Along with these efforts, SpaceX has been testing the Falcon Heavy, its giant rocket capable of flying the biggest payloads in the world, and its reusable rocket technology. In early 2015, SpaceX almost managed to land the first stage of its rocket on a platform in the ocean. Once it succeeds, it will begin performing tests on land. In 2014, SpaceX also began construction on its own spaceport in South Texas. It has acquired dozens of acres where it plans to construct a modern rocket launch facility unlike anything the world has seen. Musk wants to automate a great deal of the launch process so that the rockets can be refueled, stood up, and fired on their own, with computers handling the safety procedures. SpaceX wants to fly rockets several times a month for its business, and having its own spaceport should help speed up such capabilities. Getting to Mars will require an even more impressive set of skills and technology. "We need to figure out how to launch multiple times a day," Musk said. "The thing that's important in the long run is establishing a self-sustaining base on Mars. In order for that to work, in order to have a self-sustaining city on Mars, there would need to be millions of tons of equipment and probably millions of people. So how many launches is that? Well, if you send up 100 people at a time, which is a lot to go on such a long journey, you'd need to do 10,000 flights to get to 1 million people. So, 10,000 flights over what period of time? Given that you can only really depart from Mars once every 2 years, that means you would need like 40 or 50 years. And then I think for each flight that departs to Mars, you want to sort of launch the spacecraft into orbit, and then have it be in a parking orbit and refuel its tanks with propellant, Essentially, the spacecraft would use a bunch of its propellant to get to orbit. But then you send up a tanker spacecraft to fill up the propellant tanks of the spacecraft so that it can depart for Mars at high speed and can do so and get there in 3 months instead of 6 months and with a large payload. I don't have a detailed plan for Mars, but I know of something at least that would work, which is sort of this all-methane system with a big booster, a spacecraft, and a tanker potentially. I think SpaceX will have developed a booster and spaceship in the 2025 timeframe, capable of taking large quantities of people and cargo to Mars. The thing that's important is to reach an economic threshold around the cost per person for a trip to Mars. If it costs $1 billion per person, there will be no Mars colony. At around $1 million or $500,000 per person, I think it's highly likely that there will be a self-sustaining Martian colony. There will be enough people interested who will sell their stuff on Earth and move. It's not about tourism. It's like people coming to America back in the New World days. You move, get a job there, and make things work. If you solve the transport problem, it's not that hard to make a pressurized, transparent greenhouse to live in. But if you can't get there in the first place, it doesn't matter. Eventually, you'd need to heat Mars up if you want it to be an Earth-like planet, and I don't have a plan for that. That would take a long time in the best of circumstances. It would probably take, I don't know, somewhere between a century and a millennium. There's zero chance of it being terraformed and Earth-like in my lifetime. Not zero, but 0.001% chance. And you would have to take real drastic measures with Mars. For the space buffs, here's Musk talking more about the physics and chemistry of the spaceship. The final piece of the puzzle for figuring out the Mars architecture is a methane engine. You need to be able to generate the propellant on the surface. Most of the fuel used in rockets today is a form of kerosene, and creating kerosene is quite complex. It's a series of long-chain hydrocarbons. It's much easier to create either methane or hydrogen. The problem with hydrogen is it's a deep cryogen. It's only a liquid very close to absolute zero. And because it's a small molecule, you have these issues where hydrogen will seep its way through a metal matrix and embrittle or destroy metal in weird ways. Hydrogen's density is also very porous, so the tanks are enormous, and it's expensive to create and store hydrogen. It's not a good choice as a fuel. Methane, on the other hand, is much easier to handle. It's liquid at around the same temperature as liquid oxygen, so you can do a rocket stage with a common bulkhead and not worry about, like, freezing one or the other solid. Methane is also the lowest-cost fossil fuel on Earth, and there needs to be a lot of energy to go to Mars. And then on Mars, because the atmosphere is carbon dioxide and there's a lot of water or ice in the soil, the carbon dioxide gets you CO2, the water gives you H2O. With that, you create CH4 and O2, which gives you combustion. So it's all sort of nicely worked out. And then one of the key questions is, can you get to the surface of Mars and back to Earth on a single stage? The answer is yes, if you reduce the return payload to approximately one quarter of the outbound payload, which I thought made sense, because you are going to want to transport a lot more to Mars than you'd want to transfer from Mars to Earth. For the spacecraft, the heat shield, the life support system, and the legs will have to be very, very light. Musk spent months pacing around his home in Los Angeles late at night, thinking about these plans for Mars and bouncing them off Riley, whom he remarried near the end of 2012. Musk and Riley were divorced for less than a year. "I refused to speak with him for as long as it took for the divorce to be finalized," Riley said. "And then, once it was finalized, we immediately got back together." As for what caused the breakup, Riley said, "I just wasn't happy. I thought maybe I'd made the wrong decision for my life." And about what brought her back to Musk, Riley said, "One reason was the lack of viable alternatives. I looked around and there was no one else nice to be with. Number two is that Elon doesn't have to listen to anyone in life. No one. He doesn't have to listen to anything that doesn't fit into his worldview. But he proved he could take shit from me." He said, "Let me listen to her, and figured these things out. He proved that he valued my opinion on things in life and was willing to listen. I thought it was quite a telling thing for the man, that he made the effort. And then, I loved him and missed him.